Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome back to The Prospect Interview, the podcast where we speak to the brightest minds of today and talk about the ideas that matter in politics, arts and society. My name is Samir Rahim. This week I'm going to be talking to Rebecca Ragg Sykes, the author of Kindred, a book about the Neanderthals. Our close cousins who we lived with for hundreds of thousands of years, they've always been an object of intrigue and mystery since they were first discovered in the 1860s. If you pick up a copy of Prospect magazine, you'll also be able to read an article about our cultural attitude towards Neanderthals over the centuries. Rebecca, thanks so much for joining us on the Prospect interview.
Thanks for having me.
It's a wonderful book, and the first thing I wanted to ask was, Neanderthals have exerted such an extraordinary pull on the human imagination ever since they were first identified. Why do you think that is?
I think there's a lot of things going on, actually. I mean, it's 165 odd years now since we first discovered that the Neanderthals existed, and they represented at that time the first confirmation that there had been other forms of humanity on Earth. And, you know, that was a really big deal in the middle of the 19th century for many different reasons. So I think there's that factor that they emerged right at a point in the 19th century when many different intellectual disciplines were sort of solidifying as scientific disciplines. And there was a real emerging understanding of the depths of geological time, and, you know, trying to fit where we were placed into that was difficult. And then the Neanderthals emerge as this other type of human, and people were struggling how to place that, how to frame that. So that's sort of one factor. But also the Neanderthals immediately started to play a role as an other, you know, the archetypal other. And that has been something that has gone on all the way through since the mid-19th century, you know, through all the different archaeological discoveries and advances in how we think about things. They still play that role even today, although our understanding of them, but also our feelings about them, have shifted quite a lot.
So when they were first discovered, when, let's say, the first skeleton that was identified as being, you know, different was discovered, what were the implications realised quickly, or did it take a long time for people to acknowledge that this was actually a human, but as you say, a different kind of human?
Well, it's really interesting, actually, because it raises the question of, you know, do we only see what we're ready to see? Because the first official recognition of the Neanderthals, actually at the Neanderthal, so that's the Neander Valley in Germany, that happened in 1856, when some quarry workers were digging clay out of caves where they were mining in this very large gorge for marble and limestone, and some bones emerged, and the quarry manager recognised that they were not animal bones and therefore sort of kept them and passed them on. So that was 1856, but in fact there had been previous finds of Neanderthals, but they were not recognised as anything out of the ordinary. There was some in 18 1836 in Belgium, and also 1848 in Gibraltar, there was an entire skull that was found. It was encased in sort of, you know, crusty stuff, and it wasn't a perfect skull. So you can argue, or maybe they couldn't see, but actually, even in the original photographs, you can see it looks odd. You know, it has huge eyes and things like this. And yet it was not recorded. It was actually the Regimental Scientific Society. They just recorded it in their minutes as a skull. And it, then it sat there in Gibraltar until 1863. So after the German find. So, you know, in that sense, in the early Neanderthals were a bit like buses, you know, like there were several coming along at once, as it were, within sort of 50 years or so. But it was only at that point in 1856, when I think people's attention was really heightened towards fossil deposits in general. You know, people had been fossiling for fun for quite a while. You know, Mary Anning, a huge fossiling phenomenon, that's the early 1800s, and her stuff is marine reptiles, not Neanderthals or Ice Age creatures. But an interest had been there for a while. But I think the scientific sort of understanding of the later geological period, so the Quaternary period, which is where we find Neanderthals, that was really sort of getting heightened interest towards the middle of the 19th century. And I think that's the point at which everything comes together. And then you've got, like, you know, you've got Wallace and Darwin working on their ideas about natural selection and things like this. So things were really sort of, I guess it was a synthesis of different moments. But the other thing that's funny is that alongside all of this, since the 1830s onwards, there had also been interest in the finds of stone artifacts from different contexts in Europe, clearly, you know, deeply buried in river gravels or in caves underneath flowstones. So clearly they had to be massively ancient. They were being found with the remains of extinct animals. And yet the Neanderthal fossil remains were not found with any artifacts, or nobody noticed them. And so Neanderthals existed as these fossil type of human. And then there were these stone tools that nobody knew who made them. And in fact, it took until the 1880s, when there were some further finds in Belgium, for Neanderthal fossils to actually be found alongside artifacts. And from that point, Neanderthals had culture.
So if we're looking just purely at the physical differences, first of all, if you were to sort of, you know, magically Jurassic Park style bring a Neanderthal back to life now, how would they look different from us?
Well, I think if people, you know, I mean, I hope people in general are moving away from the idea of, you know, bent over, very sort of ugh caveman ideas, although that's been such a strong cliche for a while. But Neanderthals are very close to us in evolutionary terms, you know, chronologically. They're far more recent than our deepest other forms of hominins, so, you know, human sort of ancestral relations. We have the earliest stone tools go back to 3.3 million years ago, and the sort of types of hominins making those were far more primitive, whereas the Neanderthals actually emerge about the same time as our lineage emerges, somewhere between 400 and 350,000 years ago. So really not far, you know, in time compared to 3.5 million years ago. And on that basis, we should actually expect them to be, you know, quite similar to us. We share a common ancestor, only we share a common ancestor only 550,000 years ago. So it's all very recent. And when you look at their skeletons, in fact, yes, they are very human-like. They're a bit shorter than us, but they are fully upright in how they walk. They're bipedal, you know, walking on two legs. The differences are more sort of about shape and things like this. So for example, they have much more barrel shaped chests than we do. We have waists that sort of nip in a little bit. Their ribs are more flared, so they don't have that kind of waist that we had. And that's probably actually, rather than cold adaptations, which have been, you know, they were the favored ideas for why Neanderthals look different for many decades. We now believe that many of the physical differences may be to do with extremely intensive physical lifestyles and actually needing to get a lot of oxygen in, basically. And that could also explain another very clear difference you would see if you were standing in front of a Neanderthal, which is that their nose is really impressively large, you know, sort of Charles II type face, you know, but their whole face was different. It was pulled forward a little bit more. So from the nose and the mouth, they sort of looked a little bit more snouty, I guess, without making them sound animal-like. And that's just because they had more bone-forming cells there, whereas we have bone-absorbing cells. Their eyes, as I said, were larger, but the skull shape is noticeably sort of swept back. We have very vertical foreheads and quite balloon-shaped skulls, you know, which, you know, in that sense, we're the weird ones in our hominid family with these balloon heads and flat faces, whereas Neanderthals, which is much more sort of aerodynamic looking skulls. But there are other little differences all over the body. For example, behind their third molar, so the wisdom tooth, there was a gap between the tooth and sort of the arching part of the jaw. And that's to do with their faces being pulled more forwards and things like this. So there's a mixture of larger scale things where you would look and you would say, oh yeah, they look unusual. And then if you actually look at the bones all over the body, you pull out little other things that are going on. But I think the impression, if you met a Neanderthal, you would be really impressed with them. They're physically very, very strong, very capable, and would look extremely athletic.
One of the amazing things about the book is the amount that you and your colleagues have managed to sort of work out about Neanderthals from just seemingly sort of scraps and little bits of evidence. The teeth, for example, seem to be you work out an amazing amount about what they did just by looking at how worn their teeth are. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I mean, this is the key reason I really wanted to write the book, because although, you know, everyone's heard of Neanderthals and they're in the press a lot in terms of new discoveries and things like this, but there is just a vast amount of other stuff that we know about their lives that doesn't get into mainstream media, and it's all really fascinating. So I wanted to synthesize that archaeological knowledge, but that knowledge exists. Okay, there's you know, 165 years of scholarly work on Neanderthals, but also the past sort of 30-40 years have seen massive advances in different aspects of how we do archaeology. So we don't sort of just pick out the nice bits anymore. We collect everything. It's like total collection policy. And we do that because we've understood, for example, that if you collect all the tiny little chips and shards of stone, you can actually refit sequences of stone tool production back together and watch in reverse the decision-making of an individual Neanderthal 55,000 years ago. And, you know, early prehistorians were not doing that. They just kept the pretty looking bits. So there's that approach, but also scientific archaeology, you know, archaeological science has just boomed. There are so many sub-disciplines. And even when we're just talking about teeth, there's actually a ton of different things that we can do to teeth to find things out. So we can subject them to scanning work, using really sophisticated scanning machines, 3D scanning machines, and we can look at the growth lines. You know, every couple of days when teeth are actually forming, they have little lines that build up, and we can do that as a means to assess the different growth rates between Neanderthal children and our children, for example. We can look at the pitting on the teeth. So whenever you eat your food, micro pits and micro scratches accumulate on your teeth, and they build up a pattern. And we can see sort of at a gross scale the sorts of foods being eaten, you know, hard foods, soft foods, plants, meat, that kind of thing. So we can do that. We can similarly look for different sorts of scratches, which tell us about how Neanderthals were using their mouths as like a third hand. You know, like if you're doing something with two hands and then you need to hold something else, you sometimes put it in your mouth. They were doing that quite routinely, actually, and probably as a means of potentially holding on to things like skins. If you're working animal skins, you hold on to it and you sort of put it through your teeth and stuff like this. We can see that kind of thing going on with Neanderthals. We can even look for regional differences. And then you can look for residues on teeth as well. We can look for micro plant residues in, you know, calculus, dental calculus. So that's the stuff you go to your hygienist to get removed. That's actually really important for archaeologists. We're happy that they didn't remove it. And that can tell us, we can see tiny remains of food. So that is one area that gives us good evidence that they were eating plants, potentially boiling plants, because we can see differences in the damage to starch grains, for example. And we can even look for DNA in that as well. So there's just in their teeth, there's this enormous plethora of angles that we can take to try and find out about their lives.
You talk about them eating plants there. They have a reputation for being carnivores and hunters and butchers as well. And you do say they did have to eat a lot of calories to keep themselves going every day, didn't they?
Yeah, I mean, although Neanderthals are shorter on average, their bodies are more massive. So we believe, based on, you know, we have a really good understanding now of how our bodies work and, you know, calorific needs and sort of how much energy it takes just to keep a body running, you know, beat your heart, all that kind of stuff. And we try and apply that to the Neanderthal body and model it. And it basically comes out that they did need, you know, quite a substantial amount more calories a day. But yeah, the question of how they get that food is very interesting. And certainly for many Neanderthals through time, and I should say, you know, they emerged around sort of 350,000 years ago, and they lived all the way through to 40,000 years ago. That's a massive span of time, and that covers multiple phases of immense climate change, from glacial periods through to periods like we're in now, which is an interglacial warm period where we have a lot of forests. So Neanderthals lived through all of those changes, and that means they had to adapt to very different environments where there was different sorts of food. So Neanderthals during colder periods or in more open environments like steppe tundra, we would expect them to primarily be eating meat because it's what's mostly available. And that is what we see. But Neanderthals who were living in forested environments 123,000 years ago, they seem to have been doing more things with plant food, and that's based on sort of the wear patterns on the teeth largely. But also you look at the geographic regions, because they not only lived through this huge span of time, but we find Neanderthals across a very broad range. You know, they have this reputation as European species, but they are far more accurately described as a Eurasian, Western Eurasian hominin. And so, you know, there are some in Wales where I am, goes right through to the Near East into Siberia. But Neanderthals from the Near East, where the environments are warmer, more plant food potentially, and we do see some evidence that plants were perhaps more of an everyday part of their diet. And there are some sites where we find micro remains in the ashy lenses of hearths, for example, and all different sorts of plant food there, and fruits and legumes and things. So, you know, they certainly, everywhere they were top tier hunters in their environment. No question about that. They were skilled, systematic butchers, but depending on what was around them, they took the best of what they had, and that did include plants.
So all that you've described so far, you know, the sophisticated hunting, the tool making, skinning, communities, all this implies, isn't it, that there was communication between them, or levels of a sophisticated level of communication between them. And can we know how developed that was?
Well, it's a really, really tricky question, and there's different ways to sort of come at the answer. One is to look at the anatomy and sort of see, you know, what's possible with a Neanderthal body. And sort of, I think general opinion on that has shifted towards being conservative and saying, well, maybe they could, maybe they couldn't. But actually, I think overall now people would say that they probably could make a reasonable range of, you know, vocal noises, vocalizations. And more interestingly, there's been more recent work looking at their ear anatomy to try and work out what their hearing was tuned into. And really fascinatingly, it seems very close to ours, and our own hearing is tuned into the frequencies of speech, you know, and Neanderthals is very similar. So that implies not only that vocal communication of some sort was really important in their everyday life, but also that it probably was for our common ancestor with them as well, going back therefore 550 to 750,000 years ago. So that's probably quite a deep thing in the hominin past. But, you know, what were they actually saying is the question, isn't it? And for that, we need to look at the archaeology. And that tells us that they were cooperative in how they hunted. They had to be. And even more than that, if you look at what goes on after the hunt, I said they were systematic butchers. They were. There was not sort of like a scrum at the kill. You know, these were being taken apart very carefully, the bodies of animals. And they also systematically chose the best, most marrow-rich, fattest parts to take away and process elsewhere. So this actually seems to be a society that isn't based on aggressive competition necessarily, but is potentially much more based on sharing of resources, which would, I think, promote a context where there is vocal communication, perhaps sharing information. And then you look at other things like the technology, and you can look at how difficult is it basically to do some of the stone tool production that they did. Or you can look at some other aspects of technology, which I find very interesting, where they are making glues, because they had composite technology where they stick, you know, a piece of stone on a piece of wood as a handle, and you need the glue to that to do that. And we know they made birch tar, which you have to cook out of birch bark. And they also appear to have been using recipes for glues. There's an Italian site recently found where they seem to be mixing a pine or a conifer resin with beeswax. And cognitively, that is really quite sophisticated. And it, you know, there is very interesting ideas about links between language and the construction of sentences being made of different parts, with technology that is made of different parts that has to be constructed in an order, and hierarchical thinking. So overall, I think there's definitely some kind of language, but in terms of were they able to tell stories and talk at the level of sort of complicatedness that we're doing right now, that is the question.
And the other kind of, you know, big question that all of us sort of amateurs interested in, you know, Neanderthals are most curious about, you know, what can we know about their belief systems or their religion, if you can use that word, or their artistic bent? You know, I know there's a circle of stalagmites you write about that's been found in southern France that apparently been put together by Neanderthals. The evidence is pretty fragmentary, but what can we know about those sort of their imaginative capacity, let's put it that way?
Yeah, I think thinking about things from the perspective of imagination and aesthetics is probably a little bit safer. Like, you know, when you talk about art or religion, for us today, those have very specific meanings. They are like formalized shared systems of meaning with iconography, commonly understood symbols and things. And I don't think we can say anything like that for Neanderthals based on the evidence we've got. What we can say, though, is that whether you're talking about their choices in how they butchered animals or the stones that they used, it's clear they were really interested in quality, in material quality. And then you shift to their engagement with other materials that doesn't seem to be to do with sort of survival or function, things like pigments or fossils. And here you see a similar interest in material quality. So the amount of, as you say, it is fragmentary, but it's there across many more sites than used to be believed, and in some places in reasonably significant amounts. We can see an interest in pigments of black colours, but also reds, oranges, yellows, and linking to sort of them mixing things together to make glues, we also see pigment recipes in some places. And what are they doing with these pigments? Well, you can do a lot with pigment and, you know, natural mineral pigments, ochres or whatever, that is practical. You can use it for as like sunscreen and stuff like this. But what we see them doing it with it in some cases is applying it to surfaces and moreover surfaces of things which don't seem to be related to everyday living. So like the outer surface of a fossil shell from an Italian site is a really good example. That shell must have been found about 100 kilometers from the site itself, the cave where it was dropped, Grotta Fulmane it's called. That had to have been carried, you know, it's nothing to do with food, it's a fossil shell already. And then on the outside of it, it has a red pigment, and that pigment came from 40 kilometers in another direction. So you have these two substances, unusual in themselves, and they're brought together and apparently to change only the outer surface of this little shell. So, you know, what is that about? It's really difficult to say for that particular object, but we see similar things going on in other sites. The same sort of thing is there with eagle talons from a site in Croatia called Krapina. And one of those talons, we knew about the talons already, that was interesting. You know, why are they collecting eagle talons? We don't know. But one of those talons turns out to have a pigment mix on the outside, just a tiny bit. But again, it's not local pigments, you know, so there's something going on with an interest in materials, in altering the appearance of things. And yes, that site in France that you mentioned that I wrote about, these very large stalagmite ring structures, they're about 10 meters across, and it's a site called Bruniquel. It's in this chamber in a cave system about 300 meters into a hill. So this is not a living site. It's too dark. You know, you can't see anything without light. It doesn't make sense as a living place. But there are these two rings formed by snapping off stalagmites and selecting them by size again. So we can see this whole interest in quality there. We don't know why they made them into rings. There's also burning on some of them. But this was going on, those rings were formed 174,000 years ago. As far as we know, there's nobody in Western Europe except Neanderthals at that point. So it pretty much got to be Neanderthals. And it's utterly unique, very strange. Nothing else like that is made for, you know, hundreds, 150,000 years plus in terms of archaeology. And it's not just rings shoved together. If you actually sort of look at the structure, they have built piece upon piece. You know, this little piece is balanced. There are things stacked up. So it really is a construction. It's some sort of, yeah, built form, but we don't know what the motivation for that was. But it could link to ideas about aesthetics, about stalagmites as a strange substance. You know, there are these, if you go into cave systems, if you're familiar with caves, you know, caves are weird places anyway. They mess about with our senses, especially in the dark regions where you need artificial light. There's odd sounds, odd smells. Everything is weird. And then you look at the natural formations in caves, and quite often they look oddly organic, you know, like fingers or flaps of skin or things like this. And so perhaps they saw an echo of something familiar to them, but in this other material, this stone-like material. So, you know, who knows, but it exists. and it forces us to kind of make links with all these other interesting aesthetic things the Neanderthals were up to. And there may be something there to do with, I don't know, fundamental origins of feelings of transcendence, of, I don't know, you know, an aesthetic interest that emerges from being embodied creatures, as we all are. You know, we live in bodies, we experience things through our senses. It may be something like that.
We tend to look at Neanderthals and see a sort of fable about us, about modern humans. You think about a novel like William Golding's The Inheritors, which posits that, you know, it was the more advanced but crueler Homo sapiens who wiped out the innocent Neanderthals. Now that makes a great novel, but we have, you know, when it comes to sort of the end story of the Neanderthals, are we any clearer about, you know, why they died out, or and whether human, you know, Homo sapiens had any part to play in that?
It's hard to say. I mean, The Inheritors is a wonderful book, and I do quote from it in mine, because it is a fantastic book, and it was very important in, reversing assumptions about who we think Neanderthals are. But yeah, where we are today, I think the annoyingly, as archaeologists always say, things are more complicated. We have had a couple of big shifts in understanding. One is that we know now, and we've known for a decade now, that there definitely was interbreeding between ourselves and Neanderthals. And also, that didn't just happen at the end, at this sort of time around 40,000 years ago, after which we see no more fossils of theirs or any of the archaeology that they made. So that seems to be the end point. And there was interbreeding happening late, but also we can see that there were different phases of interbreeding going back, 200,000 years plus. So that is a different picture to the traditional idea that we, Homo sapiens began sweeping out of Africa and just sort of, knocked all the other hominins in Eurasia out of the way. That's really out of date. We know, as well as that there was interbreeding, we know that that wasn't just happening at the fringes of Eurasia, very probably, because those dispersals of early hominins of those dispersals of early Homo sapiens were not just happening late. They also were going on early. We now have evidence for early Homo sapiens about 180,000 years ago in the Near East, over in East Asia, probably 80,000 or more, in Australia by 60, 55,000 years ago. So the period of time over which we were dispersing into Eurasia and encountering Neanderthals and also other hominins who were living in Eurasia as well. So the Denisovans, a close relation of Neanderthals, that whole stretch of time has really expanded. So now I think the interesting question is, if we were so much more sophisticated, or we are assuming that Homo sapiens from its first emergence was super sophisticated, why did it take so long for us to displace Neanderthals, and why did it take so long for us to enter Europe as well? The Neanderthals seem to have had that to themselves for until at least 45,000 years ago. There's some incursions in the east of Europe from early Homo sapiens, but not before that. So why does it take so long? And I think we need to rethink our assumptions about early Homo sapiens, about those very early populations. They were not the same as those emerging in later pulses, sort of 50,000, 40,000. I think it's that later period where there may well be something different that's due to perhaps cognition, but also something that is involved in how populations are structured. So for Neanderthals and for early Homo sapiens, there's never very many of either of them around in the landscape. But we get a stronger picture from Neanderthals, and this is coming from genetics, that they lived in more isolated, cut off, smaller breeding populations, whereas you don't see that same signal from the early Homo sapiens groups. So it may be something to do with that we had stronger systems that allowed us to remain better connected across very large landscapes. And that could be important when you factor in climate change, which was going on at the time. So it wasn't hugely cold, but the climate was extremely unstable. There was a lot of massive shifts and drops in temperature and raises in temperature and things like this, and that would have massively impacted the environment and the species that everybody relied on. So perhaps you put all that together and you get a mix where Neanderthals maybe just were unlucky, and we happened to be a little bit better at some things, which allowed us to scrape through.
And finally, just we tend to look at Neanderthals as the they faded away, and we triumph. But in many ways, your book tries to refocus it and look at them at their own terms. And in many ways, they were hugely successful over many hundreds of thousands of years. I mean, what can they teach us about survival in some ways?
Well, I mean, I have always sort of thought, the end of the Neanderthals is the least interesting thing about them in some ways. I'm interested in all the different ways that they adapted to these very diverse worlds that they lived in. And yeah, they were really successful for a very long time. But I think, yes, the end of the Neanderthals and that period between 50 to 40 to 30,000 years ago, when, you know, other hominins drop away as well. And it ends up being basically just us by about 20,000 years ago. We're the only form of hominin left on the planet. You know, there is something interesting there. People have argued, well, we seem to be pretty good at forcing things to be extinct. Is that something in us? But I don't know about that. But what I do know is looking at the long durée perspective, there's a great book by Peter Brannan about, you know, the deep time extinctions that have happened on Earth, you know, tens, hundreds of millions of years ago. And quite often you see something similar. There's a lot of organisms that are doing very, very well, and nonetheless, they get extinct when times are extremely challenging. And the ones that pull through are not necessarily better adapted. I think they're just lucky. So I think, you know, there's a little bit of humility there for us. And I, as a somebody who thinks on geological timescales and about climate change and stuff, it's very difficult not to look at where we are right now, and the climate crisis that we are facing is leagues beyond what any other hominin has ever had to survive. You know, we are looking at changes on a time scale in the blink of an eye. And also, we don't have empty continents to shift into. We've got to deal with it where we are. And that's quite scary. You know, and I think we have to not assume that we will just, you know, be able to ride it out necessarily. We have to really start dealing with it. And, you know, I think maybe that's a deep time perspective that the Neanderthals can give us, that they perhaps were extinct through no fault of their own. And some of those very early Homo sapiens populations I mentioned going into Eurasia well before 40,000 years, they also went extinct. They don't have living descendants either. So, yeah, there's a lot to think about.
Rebecca Ragsdyke, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
And that's all from us. Thank you very much for joining us this week. If you enjoyed this podcast, please do subscribe and do check out the magazine as well, and our website, where you can find lots of fascinating articles on this subject and many others. Goodbye, stay safe, and see you next week.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.